What's your earliest recollection of a significant happening for you in the natural world?
I suppose that the earliest recollection of any significance for me was when I discovered the Minnehaha Falls, which was about 5 miles from my home. It was quite a unvisited place by at that time. There were people going to Minnehaha Falls, of course, but the falls itself was cascading into the canyon. There was lots of water coming down, and the area from Lake Minnetonka to Minnehaha Falls, which probably was a distance of 20 miles of stream, was pretty much unpopulated. Farms and patches of wilderness. I went to Minnehaha Falls largely to fish, I think, but of course I was fascinated by the canyon, that roar of the waterfall and the mist coming down through the canyon. And there I would, below the falls, I would fish for walleye pike in the spring. And believe me, in my family of austerity, we needed those pike as badly as we needed anything. So I managed to bring home quite a few walleye pike for our consumption at home. But there was one place along Minnehaha Creek between the falls and the Mississippi where Minnehaha Creek empties into, where there was a long slab of limestone, possibly 15 feet long, sloping toward the creek. And somehow at the very bottom of this piece of limestone, the creek had hollowed out a great area under the slab. And this was a great hiding place for fish. And I suppose they would lie there and wait for various foods to come down the stream. But whenever I would drop a short line under that slab, I'd invariably get a fish, sometimes four or five. So my mind goes back to a youthful period when I roamed that area between Minnehaha Falls and the river. And then there was a succession of trips along that creek so that I began to camp from Minnehaha Falls on through to Lake Minnetonka, which is a distance, I say, about 20 miles along a very marvelous stream. And at that time, of course, there was very little population on Lake Minnetonka. Now it's, of course, an overpopulated area with homes on every inch of shoreline. But at that time, it was quite wild. And perhaps the succession of events there was when I got together with some youngsters and we rode what we called giants down the river. They were enormous pine logs, they're probably some of them 3, 4, 5 feet in diameter. And we would ride these logs for miles and miles down the river. Often we get hung up in a log jam, but we moved down the Mississippi pretty much in a Huckleberry Finn fashion. We had no blankets, no camping equipment, no cooking utensils, and still we lived in the caves along the river. And we'd go to a farmhouse with a fish and ask if we could exchange for a loaf of bread or some corn on the cob or something of this kind. Very frequently, the farmers would take us in and give us a very fine meal. Of course, we sort of anticipated that this would happen. Kind of a skullduggery going on. We spent much of the summer down along the Mississippi, and I presume that going without any equipment, say, except one little thing we had, and that was a green, what we call a cutty hunk line, and a spoon on the end of it. And this we'd whirl around our heads a number of times, send it out into an area, a likely area for a fish, and then we'd bring that line in, and it would pile up at our feet. And we'd repeat this. Instead of having a rod and reel to cast out there, this is the way we did our casting. And there was a goodly amount of fish to be caught anywhere along the river there. And the river was not polluted like it is now, of course, so we got various kinds of fish, especially at the mouth of streams that were emptying into the river.
Well, how old were you then, Ken?
I was very young then. Let's see, I was in my elementary school years. So I suppose it was a case of being from 6 to 10 years of age. I mentioned that. And because I know we moved away from that particular area, moved into another part of the city, so that when I was in my, probably my 13th year, I was in the vicinity of 24th Street and Chicago Avenue, where I attended the Garfield School. Somehow there, I would hike from there out to Minnehaha Creek, take in pretty much the same territory, but meet it at an entirely different point. And I camped along Minnehaha Creek, I think, for many years until finally I discovered the St. Croix. And I was very young when I discovered the St. Croix River. And, of course, that was really the Eden of the outdoors for me at that time. How I came to go up there was rather a unique circumstance. Just in a casual conversation with a fellow, I imagine he was a man that probably at that time about 65 years of age, and he wore long wool stockings, golf shoes, and knickers. Knickers were quite popular at that time, and he had a kind of a sport coat on, and I thought, well, he must be a golf player because I had never seen anybody dressed like that other than a golf player. And I started to talk to him, and I found that this was just dress clothes for him when he left his camp on the St. Croix River. And he was John Campbell, a very extraordinary Scotchman who had two tents pitched up on the St. Croix River. And he would manufacture wild wines. He would put up wild berries, wild strawberries, and various berries. And then he'd come into the city and sell those, and he'd only go into the aristocratic area to sell them. And he'd ask just fabulous prices for them. I often squirm when I would hear what prices he would ask these people. Well, here was a number of bottles of wine made from the wildest fruits, and made by him, and made according to certain recipes by his mother and father from the early days in Wisconsin. He always talked about the early days of Wisconsin. And, of course, that was the famous area for John Muir where he lived. So he knew many of the circumstances surrounding the Muir history. But when I met him in the city, he asked me if I would come up on the St. Croix and visit him. And being so enthusiastic about the outdoors, it sort of appealed him. Well, I did go up there, and the way I got up there was to take a Soo Line train at the Minneapolis rail station and get off at a water tower on the St. Croix River. It was at that time, we had, of course, the steam engines, and they had to stop for water every once in a while. And they would replenish their water supply at this tank right on the river. And I'd get off at the water tower, but I bought a ticket to the next town. That's the only way I could get off at the water tower. And his camp was only about a mile from the water tower. So I'd take my pack stick and head for the St. Croix River every opportunity I had. And I'd always go up and stay with John Campbell. And he had two tents, two army tents, and all of his equipment, and kind of a workshop in one of them. In fact, he had even had a workbench in there, and all the tools, an enormous chest of tools. And he lived in the other tent. And in this other tent, he had about 3 to 4 inches of white cedar boughs covering the floor, and terrific odor in there from this cedar, sort of fresh, pungent flavor in the air. And he had a table in there, and his gas lantern. And so, I thought this was really quite a thing. But strangely, he had forgotten who I was on my first visit. And so I came along the river, and he was frying trout when I came along the river. And he didn't even look up. I suppose he just looked up when he saw me from a distance, if he saw me from a distance. And I said something apologetically about coming in on his camp. And he said something about, he says, if you're... nose isn't plugged or something, so you'd smell that I was frying trout here, and you'd head for the camp. He says, "Oh, don't be making excuses," or some such thing as that. He says, "Go inside of the tent there and get yourself a plate." Pretty soon we were eating trout and drinking coffee there, and he had this lovable, nevertheless, sort of way of slaying you with some remark, you know. And I got to love the guy. He was really, really wonderful. And eventually, we made trips into the North Country. This is a kind of a culmination point, I think, in my youthful camp.
How old were you then?
Well, I was creeping up there then, around toward my 20s, I guess. 18, 19. Well, wait a minute. No, I was younger than that, because I went into his area around Lake Superior when I was in my 20s, so I must have been considerably before that. But nevertheless, it was in that period between 15 and 20, somewhere in there.
Cal, if you only went through the 7th grade, what did you do upon getting out of school and before you were an adult?
Well, we were very poor. My father died when I was 3 years old. Of course, my mother had to go and take in washing and do housework and a lot of things to maintain a livelihood. And I went to work when I was in the 7th grade, I might say. I left school ready to go to work. Needed to help keep the family going. And I got such jobs running errands for a dry cleaning firm, and I eventually even went into business for myself. Went and bought about a dozen 1 gallon lard pails from the grocery store. The lard came in pails at that time, and they were empty. I'd clean these pails up, and I had a little coaster wagon that I fitted up to hold about a dozen pails. And I got subscribers for fresh spring water. And I'd go up to a pump 3 or 4 blocks away at one of the apartment houses. They had a marvelous spring out there. you might say, because the water was very close to the surface and had to be really pumped, we might say, to get it flowing. And I got a dozen subscribers, and I think I charged 50 cents a week for delivering water to these people, because the water wasn't too good at that time, and from the Mississippi River it was beginning to get a little polluted, and so people didn't care too much about drinking it. But I got along from one job to the other. I managed somehow to make a nickel here and a dime there. When in 1912, I left home and headed for Montana, and got out into the region around Reigate, Montana. I've told some length in my book, Challenge of the Wilderness, so it would be just repeating it here. I was there for about a year, working, mending a fence from way down in the Musselshell River Valley up to the mountains. And I would ride horseback, and I had a burro to haul fence wire and fence posts from one place to the other, equipment. And a little later I got a hold of two burros. That is, I got an extra one. And I stopped at various ranches along the way when I could. Otherwise, I would just camp out in the open prairie. But at this particular ranch where I got this burro, I was kind of the butt of the joke around there. They treated me royally. I mean, but I was just a kid, and they had a lot of fun with me. So manager, in fact, the owner of the ranch, said, "I got the mate to that burro of yours." And he said, "I want to sell him to you." And I said, "Well, I'd like to buy him, but I can't afford it." And he said, "You're going to have to afford it some way, because you're going to have to buy him." And so I either bought that mule, or I was going to take a drubbing for it, you know. And I said, "Well, I'll buy him as soon as I can afford it." So he said, "That won't do." He says, "We got to work out some kind of a plan." He said, "I'll sell him to you on the installment plan." And everything they could think of, you know, to humor me a little bit about the thing. So the next morning when I headed off with my horse and burro, got to the gate, there was a cowpuncher there, and he had the burro with a halter on him and a rope and a few extra things, sawbuck saddle and some other equipment. He says, "The old man told me to give you this." So they had their fun, you know. So I had two burros. This, of course, helped a great deal, because sometimes I had to carry high as five or six fence posts, you know, from one place to another. I cut them in a coulee, and I had to keep going over an area where there were no trees at all, and this was very handy. One of these burrows was a problem. In fact, it was the first one I had. He tried to go swimming, and every time I crossed a mountain stream, and pretty soon the current was too strong, and I started washing him away. And the best thing I could do was to get a rope on him and pull him out of there, but it seemed to me he never learned. He always thought, "Well, this is the place to go swimming. I'll never have a chance for the next 100 miles. And so the two burros, the horse and myself, we expected some kind of a mess, but I got to every mountain stream. I went up into the mountains there and enjoyed myself very much. In fact, it was a kind of a consolidated fence that I was mending. Well, the ranchers all through that country were trying to keep out the homesteaders from the ranching area. So this, as I remember, this fence was 80 miles long, and I'd ride from one end to the other, keeping it from shape. Never seemed to be able to get anybody who would go along that 80 miles alone. They wanted to work double and so forth, and they felt it was only a one-man job. And it really wasn't more than a one-man job. I could ride long distances, you know, and find no need to make any repairs. So once in a while, I'd find an animal caught in the wire, gotten loco from this loco weed that they had out there, and I'd have to shoot him if he was too badly mangled from the barbed wire, or try to get him out of there and see if he had wounds that might heal. But I rode this fence for 80 miles, and as I got up into the mountains, I would stop and camp for a week or 10 days, and this is what they told me to do. If I wanted to stop and enjoy myself, go ahead, you know. And it seemed that this probably was one of the greatest jobs in the world. You could take a vacation wherever you wanted and still be paid. And I always stopped up in the mountains. It was beautiful, you know, to get up along one of those roaring streams and catching trout and enjoying myself. All I had to do was to hobble the horses, and so I could catch them when I wanted them. And I took advantage of a good thing. I stayed there for about a year, and then they put me through a lot of routine maneuvers so I could go out there and help with the branding, and I went through the whole routine of cow punching then for another year. So at the end of the second year, I was pretty well equipped for any kind of a job on the Montana range. Mm-hmm. And one day, I just made up my mind. I got to thinking in terms of traveling in the Canadian wilderness by canoe. I'd read about a lot of it, and I'd heard about a lot of it. And at the end of the season, a fellow by the name of Williams and I, another lad from one of the ranches, wintered up in the mountains. And we had a great time there, enjoying ourselves, doing nothing but keeping warm and seeing the country. And of course, I did quite a lot of hunting at that time. We lived a great deal, of course, on wild meat. And but hunting at that time seemed to be important and significant. Until later time, when the game seemed to be getting scarce or it was overrun, I just quit hunting entirely. But I went on back to Minneapolis, I had an iron gray pony that they gave me. Really a remarkable horse. Seemed to have tremendous amount of intelligence. Sometimes he'd get his foot caught in a wire, the fence, and instead of pulling away and getting hurt, he'd just stand there with that foot dangling there, waiting for me to take it out. And it was very simple for him to lift that out, but he didn't seem to have sense enough to lift it out of there. So I'd go and lift his foot up, and he'd let out a whoop and a holler, you know, as you might say, and he would take off across the field, happy to have been released from that fence, and it wouldn't have been any problem at all for him to just lift his foot to get out of it. But he would paw, because he was a stallion, you know, and he was looking for trouble. So that probably consumed the more basics in my kid days of the wilderness.
What was the next step in the sequence, Cal?
Well, I had this idea, as I mentioned, that I wanted to get into the Canadian wilderness. And when I got to Minneapolis, I got a hold of a canoe partner. In fact, I got two canoe partners. And one of these fellows now lives in Spokane, and the other one lives out in Spokane, Washington. But we got our outfit together and went on a 3.5-month canoe trip. This is probably one of the long canoe trips of most general cruising. And we went up the Big Fork River, stopped at Grand Rapids. That's a quite a substantial town now, almost a little city. But at that time, it was just a lumber town where they gather up all the drunk lumbermen Saturday night and throw them in jail and turn them loose Monday morning without any fines or anything. And we brought our outfit to Deer River and embarked on the Big Fork River. And there we went north and spent quite a lot of time in that region. In fact, we spent 3.5 months in that region at that time. And most of the travel was, I would say, rather local. Went into the Bowstring River and into the up into the boundary to Rainy Lake, and but most of it was spent in the vicinity of the Big Fork River and Deer Lake and the various streams in that particular area. So that didn't get to be in a broad sense a long canoe trip, but it was a long canoe trip. In other words, it took in a lot of time, but not too much territory. Later, I wanted to see that whole boundary route country, and I again went up the Big Fork River to the boundary and traveled across the boundary to the Grand Portage Trail. And there I wanted to make that 9-mile portage, that famous portage from the Lake Country down to Lake Superior. It was probably more of a stunt than anything else, but it was a very difficult 9 miles because at that time the trail had grown up solid, you might say. And whereas now it's been pretty well cleared out. I think the Boy Scouts of America had a project there for brushing out the trail and keeping it in pretty good shape. But at that time, it was pretty well grown in. And it was a really one of the toughest portages I've made because, as I say, you didn't have good going. We'd carry the canoe for probably a half a mile and switch over and take the pack sacks. The other fellow would carry the canoe and so on. And we got over it. And I remember so well this fellow that I had with me on that trip. He was a city-born, city-bred fellow. And he wasn't in too good physical condition. He had a good physical-looking body, but he had never had too much physical training, I guess. And some of those portages were pretty tough. I remember one time on the Grand Portage Trail, coming along with my pack sacks. And of course, the packs were a little bit easier to get through that brush with than the canoe. And he'd been fighting that brush with a canoe for a half a mile. And when I got to him, he was sitting on a rock. The canoe was stuck up in the crotch of a tree, so he'd get under it easy again, or so I could get under it really, for the next half mile. And in a kind of a jovial way, I said, "Grand Portage, Grand Portage." And he says, "What the hell is..."
These things, kind of a hobby in India, cuts a lot of tapes of bird calls. And he wanted from $50 to $100 for one of those plastic ones, and it was big and unwieldy, and I thought, I don't really need some professional approach to this thing, you know, if I only could just focus it on some of the loon calls and some of the things that I really want. So what I did was to look around for something that would take the place of it. And I thought of dish pans and wash basins and you could think of it. And lo and behold, I went to the Restaurant Supply Company in Minneapolis. And they had a mixing bowl, a stainless steel mixing bowl, that was parabolically correct. to the dimensions. So deep from the, and the curve and everything was just right. So what I did was to go there and get one of these. It had fairly good diameter, but it's not unwieldy. And what I had to do was to cut a hole in the bottom to get the microphone in there, you know. So I told my wife, of course, I said, if this don't work, you're going to have a water basin with a drain on the bottom.
My mother used to
call me by my middle name, Frithiof.
Frithiof?
Yeah.
Good heavenly days.
Yeah, Kelvin Frithiof Rustrum was my final name after I gave up my stepfather's name. But I went to a public school called Fred Carlson. You think I was running a bunch of aliases? But Frithiof was my mother used to call, and she'd call Frithiof, you know, and everybody would say, gee, it sounds like all those red wing blackbirds, you know. I don't know, they couldn't pronounce Frithiof, so they called me Perch. That's as far as that Perch ever went through my early childhood. It was really fun.
Oh, Cal, tell me, how did you ever get started writing?
Well, it might be presumptuous on my part to think that it started way back when I was going to public schools, but somehow or other, I would be able to write a story for the paper in Minneapolis called Journal Junior. It was a junior column that the various schools and all the city used to contribute to. But I would manage to get a publication of some story very readily. When I think I was a lousy student in school as far as arithmetic was concerned. Teacher would get up there in front of my from the class, and she'd say, "Oh, now get your pencils and papers out," and we'd have to have an answer for her when she got through calling off these various figures. So she'd start probably with 6 minus 2 multiplied by 2 divided by 3. Right there, she'd lost me already. So I had no concept of what was going on for the next 5 minutes. So she'd probably call up 25 or 30 figures, and I would just lay my pencil down and listen to her calling out these figures. I know I couldn't have an answer. And even yet, I can add a column 10 times and get 10 different answers. She was exasperated with me because I couldn't seem to get along with my mathematics, but she couldn't understand how I could write a little Journal Junior story and get it published when there were 8 grades in school contesting for a chance to get into the newspaper, and nobody could make the grade with a dumb student who couldn't even add 4 plus 2, plus 6, and so on. And the result was that I got along beautifully. It seemed to be very easy to write a story, even if it was fictional. And of course, I seemed to have a knack of getting an interest in it. For example, you could say, I went to the post office today. Who cares whether you went to the post office or not? But if you said, do you know what happened to me when I went to the post office today? You'll never believe what I tell you. Now you have an interest in, and this sort of a thing I was able to dredge up for these stories so that you create this interest. Then I'd have a punchline at the end revealing some, wouldn't amount to anything, but at least to keep the reader going until we got to the end of the story. This was all the writing that was ever done for many, many years, and I didn't get to do any writing at all until I got into a habit of writing when I was doing investigation work for the American Banking Association for 10 years, and every day you would have to write our reports. Well, I got quite a few compliments on my reports from the New York office when they said that I was very careful to particularize whenever I would make an interview. For example, I'd go to a store, go to a doorbell, ring it, and somebody would come to the door. Well, I wouldn't say, if it was a lady, say the lady of the house came to the door, because I wouldn't know there was a lady of the house. I would simply say a lady came to the door, a woman about 35 years of age, light complexioned,
met a certain informant, or if you met a certain interviewee, and you said he didn't seem to be too sure of himself about this, that, and the other thing, this is the way I'd carry out my reports, so that the office would get a pretty good idea whether this interviewee was lying or whether he was telling the truth. And one time, my manager in the office, when he hired me, he said, I want you to leave here, come back in about 5 minutes, and just go down through the elevator to the street and come back and tell me what you saw. So I sit down there, and here I was writing page after page after page of what I saw. In other words, going into every minute, scrupulous detail about what I saw so that I wouldn't overlook anything. And he'd come in and he'd say, aren't you through yet? And I said, well, no, I saw a lot more than I've written already. He said, that's enough. You're doing all right. So I got hired. And the important thing was writing these reports. Well, this went along for a long time when no writing was done commercially, of course. But a big detective magazine in New York happened to learn about the Eden, South Dakota bank robbery. It was a kind of a detective type of story, because the bandits had purchased 100 pounds of roofing nails in Aberdeen, South Dakota. And it's a long story, but the point of it is that we identified the nails that were thrown out on the road, the escape road that these bandits took to puncture the tires of their pursuers. And we finally got to find out where the store was that they purchased the nails, because there's an impression on the head of a nail that a drop forging machine gives, and so you can identify where the nail came from. Well, I found it came from Aberdeen, South Dakota. But in any event, they wanted to know if they could write a story about this particular bank robbery, and if I would sign it. Well, I said, no, I wouldn't do that, but I'll write a story. You can edit it if you don't like it the way it is, and you can submit your editing to me, and if I approve it, you can go ahead and publish it under my name. But I wrote the story and sent it on to New York, and they soon had a telephone call to me, and they said, we're going to print the story exactly the way you wrote it. And not only that, but we'd like to have a contract with you to write up all your bank robbery cases while you're with these people. And they sent me a rather generous check, and it looked as though I was going to go into the detective pulp writing. But I never wrote another story on the I just didn't like the idea. The type of magazine, and there was a certain exaggeration in many of the other stories that I noticed, and they would sort of hop it up with a few additional remarks that weren't true, and I just didn't care for the thing. But then I started writing for the American Forest magazine. Just thought I'd try it. Well, I sent in an article called Has Man a Sense of Direction? And they were very enthusiastic about it. And I sent in an article, Has Wildlife a Sense of Direction? And then they wanted still another article on any subject. So I wrote some articles on the illicit trafficking of wildlife. The beaver were being trapped up in the North Country and illegally. And I happened to be in the country, and I knew who the trappers were and where the trapping was done and so forth, but without exposing these people, because I knew all of them and I wasn't going to risk being sued and so forth. I wrote these stories and used the names of just anonymous terms, and sent these in. And I started getting $150 for an article, and pretty soon another $150. I thought, gosh, maybe this beat's working. Well, went along. Finally, I did start magazine writing, and I wrote quite a few magazine articles. And one of these articles was reprinted in three different reprint magazine digests, like my Digest Review, Current Digest, and another one, I've forgotten what it was. And they seemed to think that this was pretty good reading stuff for the general public. Well, then I went to a camp, as you know. We went to Camp Lincoln. You and I were there together, so we know all that story. And the camp wanted a book on, or a manual rather, on the wilderness activity. So I wrote this book on wilderness activity for the kids, and it seemed to go over quite well. The camp took 500 copies, which is a pretty good start. But it was published by a firm in Minneapolis that only sold to schools and colleges and so forth, so they didn't have a very wide sale. And all of a sudden, I got a request from Macmillan in New York. They said, we'd like to have a book on this subject. Would you care to write one for us? Well, I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll talk to the publishing company that has published my manual. And if they'll release me, I'll use some of the material and I'll rewrite the whole thing for a book for you. And I did, and I finally got it released after some difficulty, but the publisher happened to be a good friend of mine, so he realized that he wasn't giving me the benefits of a well-published book. So Macmillan published it, and the result was that it published the usual number of books. I don't remember what they were, not 10,000, maybe 20,000 copies at the most. And all of a sudden, the Outdoor Book Club wanted the book for a premium for subscribers. So they took 52,000 copies. Mm. And all of a sudden, Macmillan got antsy about getting another book. So I started writing books for Macmillan, and I've been writing books ever since. We're on the 11th one now.
What was the second book?
The second book was The Wilderness Cabin. Mm-hmm. And strangely enough, it was a request item by the Macmillan Company. There was a fellow by the name of Chilton Aldrich who built log cabins on the North Shore. You remember him?
Oh, I have his book. He was a classic builder.
Yeah, he was a classic builder. And his wife was a writer. So I think she wrote the book. They're both deceased now. But he built some of the most extraordinary log cabins. So he wrote this book with his wife. Called The Real Log Cabin. Well, it went along and it had a good sale, I guess, for a number of years, but it wasn't adequate. They had just covered the log cabin, and there were so many things about the log cabin that had developed in the modern type of building that they wanted to know if I would write a book on the log cabin. They said, we have writers, we have wilderness activity people, and we have cabin builders, but we can't think of anybody but you and all three. So I wrote this cabin book, and it went along having just very average sale. And it finally got to the point where it was dragging its feet. Didn't seem to be selling too well. So the publisher said, either you'll have to take less royalties on this book, or we'll have to quit publishing it. And they said they have another alternative. You can buy the plates if you want to for $200. So I wrote back and I said, I'll buy the plates. Well, I didn't hear from them. They didn't cut down my royalties, and they continued publication of the book. And they went along, as I say, very moderately for a while. Then a number of very prominent magazines, Esquire and the various big magazines, start talking about log cabins and wilderness cabins, and they gave me a write-up that I would have probably had to pay a couple of $1,000 for if I were to pay for it. And suddenly the book began to sell. And the last, I recall now, 2 years ago, they published 60,000 in 1 year, and it's going good. It's a very successful book, fact, I included frame cabins, adobe cabins, all different types of cabins, and a very lengthy treatise on the log cabin. All the tools that were needed, how to use them, and so forth, so it got to be a very comprehensive publication. And so now here I am getting a book out, I was there getting a book out for me, the 23rd of September, called The Wilderness Life, and they've already called me up on the telephone and want to know when the next one is coming, so it seems I'm what they call a successful writer.
It sure as hell beats working.
You know, back at camp, you told me about how you stretched your vocabulary. I remember that. As a matter of fact, I've relayed that information to my students almost every year.
Oh, yeah, I think I remember what I said about that. And of course, I got out of school in the seventh grade, and I was giving a talk to one of the colleges here a while ago, and the MC was talking to the students at first, and then he asked for a period of questions. Well, one of the college students asked, "What is the secret of getting publication? Is there any secrets?" And the MC professor said, I think I can answer that for Mr. Rustum. He isn't handicapped by a college education. And, of course, I immediately jumped in and qualified that. But I think what he means is that you don't want to get to be a stereotype type of writing just because they tell you to do a thing in a certain way. You shouldn't just follow through the ritual. I said, and what he really means is that I had a kind of a free hand to go ahead and write the way I wanted to write, not according to some stipulated rules. And maybe this had some element of success about the thing. But speaking of this vocabulary, I had a very poor vocabulary, naturally, but I was a rather voracious reader. I read everything I could get a hold of. And I was in the wilderness long enough so that I could spend weeks on end reading good books, and this helped a great deal. What I would do when I find a book, a word in a book that I didn't know the meaning of, I would write it down on a card, and then I would show the pronunciation of the word on the card, and on the back of it I'd give the definition. And when I'd get about 50 of those cards. And I was sitting on a train or bus or someplace, I would go through these cards. Every time I found one and I couldn't remember the definition for, I would stick it in my right-hand coat pocket. And then I'd take another deck and keep going. When I got a deck in my right-hand coat pocket of all the words that I didn't know, then I would go ahead and look them all up again and study those until I had known the meaning. Well, finally, I got too good a vocabulary. they had to be listed in a question and answer item in the paper, and I had the vocabulary of a college professor, but the editors were telling me that I was using too many polysyllabic words, you know, and I had to cut back and get more terse in my writing. So what I did was to use about one-tenth of the vocabulary I had acquired, and this is the way I was most successful in my writing.
Well, it was fun for me, sitting around talking the words. Yeah. Words are fun.
Indeed they are. They're, words are so loaded with meaning and loaded with life. They must have been derived from living. Because you wouldn't have any use for them otherwise.
It's kind of good.
This is.
Tell me about some of your woodsy friends here, Cal, Felix, and John.
Well, we always develop a few pets around here. A few years ago, we developed the friendship of quite a few squirrels. And it got so interested in our peanuts that we were feeding that they would go into our pockets and take them out without us even feeding them. This year, we haven't seen any squirrels around at all. I don't know what has happened to them. But we have chipmunks, and they're getting very friendly. But we have Jonathan Anthony Seagull here, I guess, what you'd call him, has become very friendly with us and is sneaking up on us a little at a time. First, we couldn't feed it within 25 feet, any less than 25 feet, and now we feed it almost at our feet, and it's getting to be quite a pal of ours. But it's here every day at daybreak. It stands in one place, so patient until we get up in the morning, and when the bird begins to slam, then he goes walking over where they feed him. He's quite a friendly creature. Up at Seagull Lake, we had another seagull for a friend there. We called him Ham because we started putting ham out on the rocks, scraps of ham, fat ham. Always the same seagull would come back and eat it, and he got so friendly that he'd right out of our hands in time. He was really quite a pet. Sometimes we wonder whether we should feed these creatures, because when they go away, they have to go out and forage for themselves, and maybe they think that they should be on relief.
I remember over at Seagull that when we arrived, in some way no cow was back. As a matter of word, the word seemed to spread pretty quickly that cow was back, and they began to gather at the back door. And I think even before we had unpacked very well that you're already feeding the squirrels and the whiskey jacks and all the other critters that used to come around your back door over there.
We had a strange experience over there. We decided that we would start to feed a weasel, and he was running around there off and on, and we wondered if he would respond to a few pieces of fish. So we hung up some fish, and he came there daily and would get this piece of fish. Well, we finally would hang a piece of fish on a string, dangling it from the limb of a tree. And he'd go through all sorts of strange acrobatics trying to get a hold of this piece of fish. But what was the strangest part of that whole thing was that we had a red squirrel that were feeding out of our hands. And there was a question of territorial imperative. We thought, well, that weasel was going to drive those squirrels out of there. And just the reverse. The red squirrel took off after the weasel and just drove him out of the area. So maybe it's the old story about dog bites man, you know, but we certainly would have gotten 1,000 bets in favor of the weasel, but